Daniel Schmachtenberger, founding member of the Consilience Project, moderated by Nicholas Adelbert, founder of Norskin Foundation.
I'm scared to death of public speaking, so for me to dance in here on stage, the delta is a little bit wide, I must confess. Amazing to have everyone here listening into these very deep, complex, difficult discussions. My name is Niklas Adalbert, and I was very lucky with my company Klarna with the timing. It's a buy now, pay later for e-commerce, and thanks to this timing, I was part of this amazing growth journey. And I was receiving awards and front page magazines and recognition for what I was doing. And 7 years in, I reached my goal in life, which was to be financially independent. I could change my fake Rolex into a real one. I mean, how great isn't that? But as everyone understands, I mean, a fake Rolex showed the same time as a real one and looked exactly the same, and I could only eat five times per day and so on, so nothing changed. I thought I would reach nirvana, but I just felt complete emptiness. This made me reflect. It made me reflect on what we celebrate in society. And in my vertical of startups, we celebrate unicorns. So companies that reach a certain valuation, a $1 billion valuation, no consideration whatsoever if they destroy the planet or society in doing so. If we put people to debt or we create addictive mobile games which destroys people's ability to pay attention and so on, all about reaching a specific valuation. So this was the birth or idea behind Norskin Foundation, to instead put the spotlight and capital and networks behind impact entrepreneurs, so startups that are actually tackling the world's greatest challenges. And thanks to the Resilience Center, Greta Thunberg, Northvolt, creating the world's greenest batteries that we're very proud of here in Sweden, Sweden today have actually 34 times as many impact startups as the world average. And this have been feeling great to me. I mean, such a good like recognition and feeling and feeding my ego. Until Erik Fernholm introduced me to this guy here and the meta crisis. Informing me or pointing at that this embedded growth obligation we have in society, is that really compatible on a finite planet? Northvolt, I mean, if we do produce the world's greenest batteries with green energy, but meanwhile creating an ecological disaster in DRC Congo or Indonesia, is that a sufficient solution? We're coming to him. or the Jevons paradox that we also talked about, Nate was pointing to that, that even though we have added so much wind and solar, still we have a world record of coal consumption. So this is very difficult and complex, and it's obvious that just focusing on impact investing is maybe not sufficient. So, a true honor to have a discussion here with Daniel Schmachtenberger. So Daniel, where should we start? So maybe if you could give us just a reflection of Impact Week or these sessions we have had here, any like obvious thoughts?
You guys don't know that we're completely blind up here. I can't see any faces. It's such a weird experience.
Can you hear Daniel though? Yeah. Good.
Reflections on Impact Week yesterday and today. I was sitting in the audience and I was listening to Nate and Olivia and Kate today, and you know, these are people whose work I respect deeply and who are saying some of the most important things that can be said and are brilliant educators. And I was feeling the sense of the recognition that it probably doesn't matter at all. That most everybody will leave and probably continue working the jobs that they work, doing mostly the same types of things. And they will remember what happened, like, okay, we're destroying the atmosphere, we're boiling the oceans, we're killing all the other species, we're doing it at the cost of colonialism, we're on the way towards extinction. And that will last in people's minds till they scroll for a minute, until a bunch of messages come in, and until the bills need paid at most. And I'm thinking about the talks that Bohm and Krishnamurti gave in the 80s, saying very similar things about civilization being on a self-destruct path, or that Bucky gave it after World War II. And the people who listened earnestly, and everything they were saying has come to pass, and those curves keep doing the same thing. And I was thinking about the Nuremberg trials, where after World War II and the Nazis were being tried for war crimes, one of the things they were asked was if they believed in everything they were doing. And something like 90% of them said no. At first, they believed the kind of propaganda of the Jewish attack on their population and whatever. But as it got into gassing children, something like 90% of the people who were doing that said, no, I totally didn't believe in it, and I thought it was terrible. And then when they were asked, did you try to stop, they all said no. And they quoted German phrases that translated to something like officer's orders, I didn't have a choice. And I think about all the things that we would consider impact, like that was just normal life in Tibet before Mao invaded. When we talk about having a civilization that has deeper consideration for other sentient beings and deeper interiority, and Tibet was pretty great at that, and it didn't lead to their civilization continuing when a more power-oriented civilization wanted to end it. I think about, when we're talking about the impending catastrophes, I think about the 100 million Native Americans that were genocided for my country to exist just a minute ago. And we like to we talk about like the values of Western civilization, but you know, modern democracy in the United States occurred on a 100 million person genocide and massive slavery, as well as the destruction of the species. And that genocide was in this part of the exponential curve that is now verticalizing, and people don't have an intuition for how fast it goes from here. And I'm thinking about all of the Chinese soldiers who are going into Tibet, murdering nuns and priests and destroying that culture, and that similarly, they were mostly people who loved their kids and were moral people before being called into that situation. And so I'm thinking about, when I was reflecting, like, what does it take for any of this knowledge to matter? I don't know about the other speakers. I hate public speaking. You were mentioning the fear of it. Like, this is a miserable experience for me. I feel an obligation to have more people understand more of the situation they find themselves in and hopefully care more deeply. One last thing, and then we'll go back to your questions. I was on a call with a friend the other day who has done very successful work in public health globally. And it's a good guy. Is a good guy who is used to working on how to make the world better through institutional means, the United Nations and things like that. And he engaged on some projects that we were working on regarding artificial intelligence risks and synthetic biology risks, which are not obvious on the map shared earlier. The map shared earlier were talking about largely the effect of industrial era tech on planetary boundaries. But industrial era tech gives rise to digital era tech, which moves radically faster, right? When you look at the speed at which GPT got used by 100 million users, or Threads, then in 5 days, getting used by 100 million users compared to how quick it took the steam engine to be used by that many people, but also the impact of it. And just briefly, in case people don't know, because this will add something to the metacrisis, to the thesis of what's been shared so far in terms of the risk we face. The polycrisis is a term more people are familiar with, which is really good. I'm very happy about the polycrisis becoming more aware so that more common in awareness so people aren't reductively focused on climate or social justice or whatever one issue they were coming from, but recognizing there are many different critical issues facing the world and that they're interconnected and that there are cascades from one to the other and they need considered together, which is unbelievably important. We more talk about the metacrisis, which is just a slight distinction in terms of it's not just that there's a lot of different crises and that they're moving towards global catastrophic risks, but that they have underlying dynamics that give rise to them that have to be addressed. But one of the other distinctions is a different way of taxonomizing the problem space, and the issues of advanced technology get some more emphasis. So probably, I mean, I know Nick Bostrom and Anders Sandberg and Max Tegmark are Swedes, so everybody here is probably actually fairly aware of AI risk more than in lots of places. But, you know, there was some studies done in the U.S. just in the last couple weeks on the relationship between the publicly deployed large language models, GPT-4-like things, but the ones that have been jailbroken so that they don't have the same restrictions on them, and pretty much everyone that has been deployed has either been leaked, reverse engineered, or jailbroken very quickly. And the relationship between those and biological development tools, the ability to synthesize genomes of pathogens and things like that, and just asking questions to an AI that can talk to you, that knows all of chemistry, that is published on Wikipedia and online, knows all of biology, knows all of current technology, which would normally be a radically huge team needed to do that, and being able to ask questions like, which companies provide gene synthesis tools that are not government monitored, where I can buy gene synthesis tools without triggering oversight, and what are the most virulent pathogens, and how many people could I kill for $100,000? And questions like that, and it answering. And this is totally nuclear weapons level catastrophic capability, but unlike nuclear, you just have to have an information packet to be able to use it. The knowledge of how to do that travels the speed of light on the internet, radically decentralized, can't be limited to G8. And so and yet from the economic perspective of what every speaker today was talking about, exponential curve goes up, software seems like the answer to planetary boundaries, right? Because we get to keep getting more economic growth without having to use as many resources per dollar. Awesome. We're definitely moving forward as fast as possible with AI in the US in the hope that it'll fix the stagflation and allow us to deal with the economic situation. But it's dual use, it's omni-use, it's basically meaning you develop it for one purpose, but it enables everybody to do every purpose that they have. And the radical enablement of the distribution of human purposes as they exist today is super problematic. But the thing that I was talking to my friend about is we were working on these issues. How do we regulate that type of AI and that type of synthetic biology that has nuclear level catastrophic capabilities, but that non-state actors can get? And he was suggesting to me that he'd already made action on this. We have to make a public-private partnership where we get all the big AI companies and all the big synthetic bio companies involved, because they're the only ones who know the information and they're the only ones that can move fast enough because government moves too slow. And they'll be able to come up with the regulation for themselves. And he was serious. He was actually serious about this. And I'm like, are you kidding? are you kidding about this? And I said, we can't have any revolving doors in this. The people who are regulating the tech cannot have a vested interest in the tech not getting heavily regulated. And he got so frustrated at me. He's like, Daniel, everything in DC is rotating doors. And I'm like, I know, that's why we're going to go extinct. And he got so frustrated he almost had to hang up, because he's like, you're being so unrealistic. because this is how regulation in the world works. And I'm like, you're being so unrealistic. You're pretending a biosphere can continue to exist. And the issue is that he was grounded in the reality of human history as it has been so far. And I was trying to ground in physics and biology, because we don't get to change those in the same ways, and the two aren't compatible. So I have to be unrealistic to history as it has been so far if I want to be able to think about how to make a human technological civilization compatible with the biosphere and itself and its own continuity. And I think, yeah, one thing, like if I'm gonna express what I was reacting to today, is that I do believe we're at the end of history. Like eminently in the lifetimes of everyone in this room, we're at the end of history. Meaning we're at the end of a human civilization defined by the major defining characteristics that what we call written human history from early Egypt or Sumeria or whatever was defined by, which is if you had a peaceful civilization and Genghis Khan wanted that area or Alexander the Great wanted that area, your peaceful civilization was wiped out. And the same is true if you want to internalize all of the cost of carbon, your country is going to get destroyed geopolitically by whoever externalizes that cost and concentrates the profits. The thing that has been more successfully dominant, extracted more, grown its population more, increased its violence capability wins. And that thing, with exponential tech at planetary boundaries, self-terminates. So either we're at the end of our species, or we're at the end of our species being defined by those parameters. And the end of our species being defined by those parameters requires, and I think the last thing I'll say when I was thinking about the Nazis and everyone else in those situations is the famous quote, lots of people have said a quote like this, that it's the complicity of the weak with the wicked that allows the evils of the world to happen. Most of the Nazis were not Hitler, but Hitler couldn't have done shit without a lot of people who obeyed. Most of the Mongols were not Genghis Khan. Most of us are not the people that make the choice to make up bullshit reasons for wars that are false flag for truly economic and geopolitical reasons, but we will still not get in the way of that thing happening. The Iraq war that started all of the recent rounds of wars because of the weapons of mass destruction that we knew they didn't have. Where are the prosecutions for that? Because 4.5 million people were murdered as a result of that. There are a small number of people who are motivated by power exclusively, pretty exclusively. And then there's most everyone else who just needs to pay the bills and not rock the boat too much and wants to feel like they will do good things within the confines of that. So I guess I don't want people to think about how to make their own life regenerative because it doesn't matter. I don't want people to think about how to make Sweden regenerative. I want people to think about what it would take to turn the entire arc of humanity, factoring what is currently driving it, and that everything else that you could do doesn't matter at all, because the end of the possibility space of all meaningful human activities is imminent if we don't do that. That's what I'm reflecting on.
Wow, where do we take it from here? Do you think it was any like missing perspectives or anything we need to add to the previous models? Or do you rather think we should go into like, this is not sufficient, what is then a sufficient solution to you?
Yeah, we didn't talk about war in the previous models very much.
Let's talk about war.
When we study history, we study war a lot because history is very significantly defined by war. Right now, we're talking about markets as the defining characteristic. Markets and war are co-evolutionary structures. They're both structures of how to grow and empower populations in rivalrous conflict with each other. In fact, you can think about what we call war as kinetic warfare, zero-sum type competition using bombs and guns and stuff. And you can think about what we call economics as economic warfare, political warfare, diplomatic warfare, narrative warfare. And von Clausewitz's famous statement that war is politics by other means. And so I think understanding the role of conflict in the ecological crisis is very important. I think, you know, like the best country on Kate's chart was Costa Rica. They don't have a military. Also because they don't have extractable natural resources. And they don't have some critical international thing like a Panama Canal or whatever, so they don't have to have the resources allocated to military and that kind of thing. But, you know, when we look at the history of warfare, we didn't have the ability in war to destroy everything until World War II. And World War II was a minute ago in historical terms. And at the end of World War II, there were about 2 billion people on the planet, which was already a 4x jump from what there was for all of human history till the Industrial Revolution, right? Until the Industrial Revolution, we didn't have the type of tech that could destroy the biosphere, because you can't overfish the oceans with fishing rods, right? You have to overfish the oceans, you have to have massive industrial fishing equipment, and on and on. So all of human history only brought us to 500 million people until the Industrial Revolution, and then we're like, oh, look how awesome the Haber-Bosch mechanism is, but corresponding to we can feed a lot more people is all of the planetary boundary issues we're hitting now just a couple hundred years later, because we went from 500 million to 8 billion overnight. But we went, at World War II, we were up to 2 billion, but only 2 billion. That means we went from 2 billion to 8 billion since then. And that's because part of the solution to don't use these nukes was radically grow the economy via globalization. The globalization solution, which was key to the post-World War II, how do we have the superpowers not war? Because throughout all of history, there have not been long periods of peace where the superpowers don't war, because the superpowers are run by power-oriented people. And who want more stuff, and they get more stuff by taking other people's stuff. And so, but now, with nuclear bombs, we have a war that nobody can win, so for the superpowers to not war, they'll still have proxy wars, which we've had. They'll still have wars on the global south, they'll have wars on the environment, but they can't have a direct kinetic war. And so the answer was, let's connect the whole global system. And there was some brilliance to this, through globalization, so that we don't want to bomb each other because we're bombing our own supply chains. You have to think about this when you start thinking about localization. Because if you make things more local and we're not interdependent on each other, we have less disincentive to bomb them, right? So that was one of the reasons for the radical globalization, but it did, of course, create these radically complicated, fragile supply chains where if anything happens and they go down, everybody's fucked. And we saw that in COVID, right? We saw that to stop the travel of the pathogen, fertilizers and pesticides weren't able to move, and you got locusts in North Africa and the Middle East, and you got crop failures in India and like that. But the let's radically financialize and deregulate the world so that everybody, and globalize the world so that everybody can have more stuff and the superpowers can have more stuff without having to take each other's stuff, did produce 75 years of non-kinetic war between superpowers with proxy wars the whole time. But it also 4x'd the population, 100x'd the resource consumption per capita of, you know, what it was at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and developed AI and synthetic bio and cyber technologies and extincted 13 species a day. So when we look at that picture, if we start to degrow, there are a lot of people who are like, nah, I would rather not have less. I'd rather there be less of other people's people, and I think that we can win the war. So one of the challenges to degrowth is that that has been the only thing that's prevented, the growth equation has been the only thing with these kinds of people and patterns that have prevented World War III kinetically. So we have to factor that. So I think the role of war violence is critical. I think the, to add to the story, I think the role of advancing tech is critical to add to the story. Because when we're largely looking at the results of the industrial tech that have cumulative effects, the exponential tech allows us to have cumulative effects much faster, but also not just cumulative effects, but radically rapid catastrophic effects. And then we have to look at the underlying drivers. Why can we not stop this thing? Why is it that literally no country, no company in the world wants climate change? Nobody is like, climate change is the world that I want. But we're orienting to it so fast and we can't stop, and nobody can stop it. Because we all want stuff that requires energy that is driving that thing. And nobody wants species extinction, and nobody really wants to live in a world with automated AI weapons, but we're all racing to build them. So what the fuck is actually driving the world to a world that literally nobody wants? I think there's a deeper analysis of that, and the market is a part of it.
I immediately think, should we continue to elaborate that? What is actually driving that?
Sure.
Or do you want to continue over to the market? Yeah, please continue.
Think about the scale of the market for a minute. You have something like $100 trillion exchange hands every day. And as has been made clear, all of that involves energy that is involving mining and fracking and extraction and pollution on the other side. It also, even the services sector depend upon products. So all of it has a materials footprint. It all requires central banks. It all requires militaries. Nobody gets to make money in that contract hold without the military that holds the monopolies of violence and everything in place that keeps that economic system going. So all of those dollars, the taxes that they pay and whatever, are supporting that whole system, right? So Norskin is one of the probably larger impact companies around. And if you have, whatever, a few hundred million dollars to invest, and we're talking about $100 trillion a day of activity that is right up at planetary boundaries and at the verticalizing part of the exponential tech curve, how do you leverage any activity to be able to affect $100 trillion a day no longer being harm externalizing? That's a question we have to take really seriously. But so that's the size of the economy today, and it's obviously growing exponentially just to keep up with interest. And if we didn't grow exponentially, you wouldn't keep up with interest. The financial system, as we know it, would collapse. So we have a financial system that the world, how we meet our basic needs depends upon, that is so obviously incompatible with a biosphere. What the fuck? We did just, it is so ridiculous. But so, what is the market? Think of it as money is a kind of token for value. It's a kind of token for game theoretic optionality, where it has no intrinsic value, but it has maximum optionality to get me any type of value I want. I can get militaries with it, I can get media influence, I can change people's minds, I can get materials. And because I don't know how the environment's going to change, the speed of adaptive response is the most important thing, the OODA loop, the speed at which I can respond to the environment. So I don't want a lot of materials that might become less useful. I want a lot of optionality to have whatever I want, right? And so if you think of money as a proxy for value, but only value that is measurable, extractable, and exchangeable. And all the types of value that on your deathbed you'll really care about are not measurable, extractable, and exchangeable. We'll destroy all those types of value in the pursuit of these types, and we have to because they are. Right? And so now think about that as a decentralized incentive system that is incenting all the 8 billion humans to figure out how to get it, because everything else they want requires it, and everything they need to exist requires it, the countries relative to each other, the companies relative to each other, the people relative to each other. And so it incents them to innovate, and it incents them to act on existing innovation. So search algorithms and optimization algorithms, right? And so you can think of the global market as something like an AI, an intelligent system that is running parallel process on human compute, on human beings. And you know how radically powerful parallel process in the cloud is. Being able to run a lot of parallel process on computers did a lot more than centralized supercomputers could do. So this is running parallel process on 8 billion human beings and the clusters of corporations and countries and whatever to incentivize them all to search new ways to make money and to optimize on existing ways. And whoever gets good at that system gets more power in it and in turn lobbies and changes laws and changes cultural values of the media they create and whatever that makes the system better for them. And anyone that opposes that system is also opposing those who are doing well at it. So that there is agency to suppress that. So you can think of the global market as a misaligned superintelligence that is already misaligned with planetary well-being in humans, that is running on all the humans while also running all the humans, that also uses all the compute and all the other technology, and that is building all of the narrow AIs in its own service. We said that most of the Nazis weren't Hitler. So the Hitler we're all in relationship to today is this thing, right? We can call it Moloch. But this kind, you can call it the superorganism, you can call it the mega machine. And that thing has to die. That thing has to die or the biosphere will die. But it's not actually animate. It is running on and made up of human action. And so thinking about what would it take to, and it has to die and or be converted to something that it is not. And the something that it is not is that you can't assess all types of value with a single value currency, a fungible value currency where the real types of value can't be measured there. And where you can destroy real value to get the optionality token for value. That thing, there is no global, fungible, unitary currency with its own internal financial mechanisms like interest that create embedded growth obligations. There is no system that has those structures that is compatible with human continuance. So that thing has to change. And for people in here to have a future where you don't live in cognitive dissonance, if you get that, then you can't operate within that thing anymore. You have to say, fuck, how do I change that thing? I can't operate within it. Because I can't be complicit with an omnicidal thing.
So does it need to break, or can we bend it?
There is no human future that is compatible with a single fungible global currency and interest and most of human access mediated by property, private property ownership. Those things are fundamentally incompatible. We can do the math on that sometime. Back in 2017, I wrote a series of papers called New Economic Series, and it addresses a chunk of this stuff. No making the money crypto doesn't solve it. So first, the money is supposed to index real value, goods and services, right? Like the theory of the market was people want real shit that will improve their lives. And barter is just, and there's a lot wrong with this. And you can read Graeber and others to see what's wrong with this, but like very simplified kind of market apologism. Early market theory, a la Smith and friends, says people want real goods and services that will improve the quality of their lives. How many cows are worth how many shoes is really hard. So we make a unit of currency that's easier to carry around and where you don't have to cut up the cows each time to be able to mediate that kind of barter and exchange. And people will buy the product or service that meets their need the best at the best price. So this creates the authentic demand, creates an incentive for other people to figure out supply, to be creative, and that it's not money as a measure of extraction, but money as a measure of production. We're adding value by putting pieces together in a form that wasn't there. And that the intelligent, rational human will pick the thing that meets their need the best, and the world will get better, right? Like, that's the gist of the idea. And it's supposed to be then that the money is indexing the real goods and services. So how much money is there has to be that within that market, you kind of know how much goods and services to know how much one unit of currency is worth, which is why counterfeit is always illegal. Because if you just added a bunch more currency that wasn't indexing the goods and services, you'd be debasing the value of the currency. But as soon as that the financial system, you start to realize, okay, well, now I have some of this money that is an optionality token for any kind of value, and I can give some of it to someone else. I can loan some of it to someone else so that they can buy the tractors or the horses or the whatever they need to do a thing, where then they will grow the productivity. Some of that increased gain that they get, I should get back, so we call that interest, rent seeking or interest. And then now we have a situation where just the reality of interest requires the system to grow the monetary supply. Now, because the population was growing and because we were technologically innovating, the system was growing. But now that we're at a situation where we can't keep growing because we've hit planetary boundaries, because there's 8 billion people and 100x the resource per capita that there was before industrial tech, the monetary system still requires there to be 3% more money next year and then 3% more on that, which is a compounding curve which goes exponential. And to not debase the value of that currency, that means you have to exponentiate real goods and services, which means rather than the money following the real economy, it's driving it, right? Can you that embedded growth obligation is totally incompatible with planetary boundaries. So do you have to change financial services to not have an embedded growth obligation? Absolutely. There's a lot of other structures that we can get into that have to change. Now, can we bend, not break? There is immediate work we have to do because we're so near tipping points. We're past tipping points, right? Like, if everybody, probably many people in here saw the article that came out about 6 months ago in the American Chemical Society Journal about PFAS, the fluorinated surfactants in rainwater everywhere in the world. But they are in rainwater, like these fluorinated surfactants, which affect their endocrine disruptors and carcinogens and neurotoxins, they're in every drop of rainwater all around the world that has been studied, including snowfall in Antarctica. And they're at levels that are above the EPA and EU thresholds. That's not we're getting close to planetary boundaries, that's we have crossed them, and the cascade of tragedies we don't know yet. We don't know. If we stop using hydrocarbons, awesome. But if we stop the pollution and these are forever chemicals, what? They're still there. And they're not just affecting the humans, they're affecting the soil microbes and the algae and everything, the gene lines of those things. So we're already past some planetary boundaries, we're near other ones. There's immediate shit that has to happen. We have to use markets and governments and whatever for that because that's where all the power is, but we have to use them very differently than they, so we kind of have to hijack them. And so what does that look like? It looks like that the most toxic forms of agriculture that deplete all the minerals in the soil and use pesticides and herbicides, i.e. poison that was designed to kill life and spray it all over our food and spray it in the ecosystem in billions of tons of year, that shit is subsidized by the governments of the world, i.e. it's not even market competing with regenerative agriculture, it's being subsidized to not even allow fair competition of the other things when it is omnicidal because it claims it's the only thing that can produce enough food to meet food security for national interests. No, the real reason is because they're fucking better at lobbying than small farmers are. So what's an immediate thing to do? Do you need lobbying? Do you need people who know how to lobby as well as big ag and big pharma and big oil and big tech, who go and lobby for opposite purposes to remove the perverse subsidies that are going to those and move them to the things that would be better, that are still market viable things, so that the market topology changes? A small amount of lobbying money can produce a lot of state money change, which can produce a lot of market change because you've changed the topology of the market. These are examples of not changing the underlying logics of the market, but working with them to change the world in the timely things. I call this triage. And that needs done in a lot of sectors. There's transitional work, which is to make the existing systems less pathological. How do we change? So how Kate's work with the donut would be an example of, insofar as governments start actually forcing monitoring of externalities and making it illegal. So the externalities have to be internalized in the cost equation. That would be a good example. Insofar as they start to change the fiduciary responsibility from profit maximizing to things that are not ecocidal and biocidal and lifecidal in the process of economic viability. Those would be transitional. And then long-term is totally rethinking, okay, we know how to split an atom now. Wow. Like, re-go back through the high school physics of how small an atom is. And the fact that we have figured out how to split an atom, to actually how to do fusion, right? How to do this at the level of the nucleus of an atom. And we know how to modify genomes of species and make new synthetic life that never existed before. And the fact that we know how to reverse engineer brains and make these massive neural networks that can do exaflops per second of calculation, the fact that we are the major geologic force shaping the surface of the planet at this time in the Anthropocene, that's a lot of fucking power that we have from our intelligence. To think through, what would it mean for our species to be wise enough to steward that power safely? What kind of civilization, what kind of economic system, what kind of governance system, what kind of education system, what kind of religious systems of conditioning the sacred and meaning are necessary to be able to steward the power of synthetic biology and artificial intelligence and nuclear tech and globalized supply chain industrial tech to steward that safely? That's the long-term work, but that we don't get time to do if we don't do these other things.
We only have 8 minutes left, so I guess it's like a third question we can fit into that. Hearing all the messages of today's presentations, hearing you now, just a side reflection, I'm just realizing this is not only like virtue signaling to sit here with you, it's also like cognitive signaling, pretending I understand everything you're saying, but that's a kind of good feeling. I mean, digesting this, how can you not become depressed if you really take this in? Because it's quite complex. It's just so dark what you're saying and what we need to do as society.
I think people... Can you hear me? Okay. I think people should let themselves become depressed. I think if they are not, they're so schismed inside, it's hard to even think of people as humans. If you can know the reality of what's happening in factory farms and just be stoked, it's not my problem. If you can know how many kids are in the sex trade globally, if you can know what the destruction of species looks like and you aren't depressed, there's something really wrong with you. But the reason you're depressed, if you let yourself be, the reason that you might not be is because you won't let yourself be. Either you're actually an obligate sociopath that just can't feel shit, or you won't let yourself be because it's overwhelming and you don't know what to do with that. Trust that. Let yourself go there anyways. And then recognize that the reason you're depressed is not just what it means for you, but because you love animals. And the animals that are being destroyed are not that different than your dog. And because you love kids, not just your own, and the other kids that are being in totally fucked situations, and the future kids that won't have a chance at life are not that different than your kids. And the reason for the depression at all is because life is actually beautiful and sacred, and the depression is recognizing the destruction of the sacred. But then there's like, okay, well, I'm here. And I have some agency. I have some capacity. I can do something about it. I don't know how to yet, but I'm not going to let myself do anything other than figure out how and then act on that. And then when it's insufficient, figure out how. As opposed to, I'll wait till someone else figures it out, or when I figure out how, even though I'm not allocating time to trying. So, yeah, I want people to feel the depression and the outrage and the fear, because it means that they are not just deadening themselves and fragmenting inside. And then I want them to not allow themselves the cognitive dissonance to forget and just care more about the messages that came in today that totally don't fucking matter in comparison. And then I want you to realize that you can't focus on the bad guy over there. And then you also can't let yourself stop or not act because you don't know how, but you also can't act doing things that you know won't work, so you have to learn. You have to try to figure it out and talk to other people that are. And then recognize that if life was not actually beautiful, meaningful, and sacred to you, you would give no shits at all that it's being destroyed. And so don't act out of anger, depression, and fear. Act out of that sense of the sacred, and that you are in service to a life that is beautiful, to a life with a capital L, a world that is beautiful, and that you're at a time when there is a higher possible consequence of your action than there has ever been for humans. And there is an obligation in that, and there is a meaningfulness in that, that you don't want to waste.
Final 2.5 minutes. Any final words that you want to share with us? Anything that you think we have missed? Any like call to action for all of us?
Yeah.
Super highly skilled and capable and people here with a lot of agency.
Yeah. I'm reminded of the Krishnamurti quote that being well adjusted to a profoundly insane society is not a good measure of health, good measure of mental health. It will seem like I'm trying to radicalize you, and I am, but I'm not trying to radicalize you. I'm trying to talk about the only thing I feel is sane at all in a world that is completely batshit crazy. And then I don't want to moralize you uselessly, so you just kind of feel bad on your way to bed while continuing to do the same shit. So the question I was talking about at the beginning of how does any of this matter, a practical thing, I would say, is that your social media feed will continue to show you the same shit, and your bills will continue to call at you, and your media will continue to show you all the things that it does that are all wrong, and your existing obligations will continue to push on you, and that you will not be able to counter that by memory and will alone. You will have to change the feed of what's coming into your awareness, where this comes into your awareness every day. So put Nate's podcast, put the work of the other people that are waking you up or reminding you of things you know, put that on your daily feed somehow. because the whole we are the average of the five people we spend the most time around, our consciousness is influenced by what we're paying attention to. Make sure that what is most, the truest thing you know is what is getting your attention the most. Change who is around you and change the information feed coming to you such that what is most true and meaningful is what you're getting reminded of the most. If you can, like literally tonight, start thinking about who you know that reminds you of these things that you can start spending more time around and send them messages, what things you can delete off your phone, what social apps you can just delete, what new ones you can add, like that's a practical thing that you are, that what is conditioning your consciousness continuously is aligned with what is most real.
Daniel Schmachtenberger, thank you so much.